I'm Akko.
And I'm Marcy.
I'm Ethan.
And I'm Nino.
And welcome to the Color Pages Book Club.
This is a wild gag that we keep doing.
I know, yes, I'm shocked to be gag. Here too.
But yes, speaking of shocked, welcome to the Color Pages Book Club, a bi-weekly podcast that focuses on fiction, fantasy, and magical realism by writers from colorful backgrounds.
Ooh, yes, colorful backgrounds indeed. And today, we are going to be finishing up our conversation of On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. And we are joined by the amazing, the lovely host of the Left Shelf podcast, Nino, Ethan. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having us, of course.
Yes, of course, of course. Would you mind telling the listeners who you are, what your show is about? Like, yeah, just a little bit about yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it, Ethan.
Okay.
I believe in you.
Okay. So we are Left Shelf. So Nino and I have been friends since the womb. And you know, we just used to talk about literature. We used to talk about leftism. Then we thought, why don't we just do it both at the same time and combine it, make a podcast? So yeah, so we are also bi-weekly. We don't do two episodes per book because we don't have a lot to say. But yeah, so you know, that's us. We're all kind of in the same podcasting place in this world.
It's true. Our little virtual book club.
Yeah.
And you guys should definitely check them out. They're very amazing. They have just a lot of great episodes. They're far more concise than us, which is wonderful.
Yeah. Y'all also talked about White Teeth, which I really appreciated, by Zadie Smith, which is just still one of my all-time favorite books. So yes, definitely echoing Akko. Want to definitely check them out.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah, there's some books that you're like, I need to have a physical copy of this at all costs, and like White Teeth is definitely one of those where I just checked it out from the library, but now I'm like, I need to get it because I want to highlight it, I want to do things to it. Yeah.
Okay, no, so I just same. It's funny that you said I just purchased it and I'm about to start reading it. Ooh. And I was like, people really, you know, I don't know, they sing very high praise about this book, so I'm excited.
Yeah, well, let me know what you think.
Ooh, I'm so excited. Maybe I'll do an episode afterwards. Yeah. Look at that. Speaking of letting people know what you think, I have a question.
What is your question?
What is your question, love?
I feel like my transitions for questions have been pretty bad lately, but that one was like chef's kiss.
No, honestly, true. Like, A+.
So the book we're reading is called On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. And last week I asked Marcy what it meant to be briefly gorgeous. And so now, because I basically think I'm a TA for a literature class in your local college, I'm going to ask you all the following. On Earth, we are blank, blank, blank.
Ooh.
Oh,
ooh.
My God.
Oh, my God.
When you say, okay, clarifying question. When you say blank, 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 does it have to be three syllables or three words?
It doesn't have to be three anything. That was just an ellipses done.
Okay. Oh, my God.
Okay, I've got mine. Mine would be, okay. On Earth, we're always hungry.
I feel like this has two meanings. Like, on Earth, like, I also always want a Pop-Tart. But also, on Earth, like, we're always hungry for satisfaction or, like...
Yeah.
I don't know. Our dreams to be... Well, I don't know. Ethan, is that what you...
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's it. Well, because I was just thinking about how, personally, I am hungry. And, you know, from there, it hit me.
That's fair. That's fair.
Now if I'm like, on Earth, we're always thirsty, that's like...
Oh, I'm always thirsty.
That would just be so lazy. But Nina, what were you going to say?
I really love that. On Earth, we're always thirsty. I was going to say, on Earth, we're deeply together.
Ooh. Okay, I like that. I like that a lot. Expand on it, Nina. Tell us. She's like, damn, I should have done Hunger Years.
I think what struck me about the title was this focus on the earth too, like on earth we're briefly gorgeous. And I was wondering like why he specified earth like that as a place, and it felt kind of spiritual in a way, and in a way how like history on earth kind of repeats itself, how earth in and of itself is round, how everything that starts kind of comes back together. And so that's kind of the idea that generated my thought.
Oh, I like that. I like really that like a that. Lot.
Oh my gosh. I don't know. Akko, do you want to go before? Yeah.
So mine was thinking, to your point, you know, about it specifically being something about Earth. I was kind of like, on Earth, we are human. Mm. Almost like to be our humanity and our this experience we're having is so intrinsically tied to the fact that this planet exists and that we're on it and that we spring from it and everything it's been, and we are a continuation or an extension of the earth, like, you know, same way trees or plants are, and this whole human experience we're having, this thing that's briefly gorgeous is our humanity. So on Earth we're human.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
Can I do snaps? Gosh.
See, this is... Yeah. Of course. We may snap, yes. Oh my gosh. No, I really, really love that. And it's so funny because like both of yours, that's kind of like where my mind keeps going. I'm like, I want to keep saying like on Earth, we're like really connected or something to that theme. But I'm trying to like, For a second, I almost wanted to say on Earth we are indebted, but I was like, that seems kind of a lot.
No, well, let's follow this. Let's follow this thread. I like
workshop it.
Like, just in the sense that, like, I think it's funny. I feel like we kind of had a similar conversation when we were talking about the Stone Sky and the Broken Earth trilogy. But like, when I think of Earth as like a place, like, yes, like I think on a spiritual level, I agree with, like, you know, we are. Like, there's nothing intrinsically separate between ourselves as people and, like, the earth itself and, like, other forms of life. But as we've sort of moved throughout history and time, like, you know, at least in sort of these Western paradigms, there can be this kind of separation that, like, earth is something that we can be acted upon. It's, like, it's sort of a passive means through which we can, like, extract resources and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And so I think of... indebtedness is rooted in this idea of capitalism, which is why I'm kind of like, but like, I like the idea of like being like, oh no, we need to, this is a space to which we need to show reverence. We need to be actively showcasing like our appreciation and our love for the space, because without like a ground to stand on or, you know, air to breathe, things that like literally we would be obsolete. And so that's kind of where my thinking is around that. So maybe got to workshop the words a little bit, but that's the idea.
Yeah.
So.
And maybe if we were kind of like our point about maybe your word looking for is like reverence, just because like if we had this feeling that we weren't entitled to not just the earth, but people, maybe we would be able to be more as opposed to so consumptive of each other and like the earth and et cetera. Maybe.
Love that.
Yeah, I feel like there's this general way of looking at the earth as like something to be owned and something to be dominated. And it almost feels like, especially in this day and age of technology, it almost feels like people completely disregard place and think of themselves as like above place, like location doesn't matter, like we now have this kind of like virtual reality, we can do everything from anywhere, and so to kind of invert that and to say that no, actually place makes us, we don't make the place. I think it's I think it's really, really clever in that sense. So I really like that, Marcy.
Ooh, Nina.
On Earth, we're local.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. This is our hometown.
Yeah.
I really like that. The place makes us. It is because we're on Earth that we are gorgeous, or this type of gorgeous.
And I like the idea of place specifically mattering, because otherwise, when there's an idea that like any place is just like any other place, and like where you are specifically does not matter, I think it does allow for that flattening of I feel like the more I do this podcast, the more I talk like Akko, I feel like that's just what's been happening for years. It's like kind of a flattening of like the nuance of where we are and sort of like the specific like histories of like, yes, the land itself, but also like the those who have like, you know, been on top of that land and who have occupied that land and stuff.
Right.
And so I like that. Place makes us.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
And the thing is, I'm sure we'll get more into when we discuss the book, but I think there's this upheaval that happens when you're an immigrant, when you have lived in two different countries, in two different places, and in two different locations that are vastly different from each other. And there's a sense where you don't feel grounded, like you don't quite have roots anywhere. Mm-hmm. But I really thought it was clever in this book how the title was On the Earth, that you still have a place to claim. Yes. I guess you still have a geography to claim, even though like as part of this and as an immigrant, you move around and you feel like that location isn't there. It's actually there and it's the whole earth.
Mm.
And I don't know. I like that.
No.
That's so wonderful. I in one of the moments of one of my multiple existential crises, of which I have, truly it's like putting cereal in a bowl, like, oh, Akko woke up, she had an existential crisis. But was talking to one of my parental figures, and I was like, I feel like I just don't belong on this planet. I just don't belong. And he was like, there is no place that you don't belong. There's the earth, you are human, and therefore the earth is, any place on earth is a place you belong. And I think that's true. I think you're so right about, to be an immigrant is to get into this like liminal space of where you're moved from this place that made you, that created you in so many ways, and put in a new place, and then asking yourself like, how far does being human on earth stretch for it being your home? Like, how far to the edge of that definition can we get? And I think you're right. I think Ocean, or his, you know, protagonist little dog, is definitely debating that in his head and trying to like make meaning out of that. Nino is just coming A plus on all her exams. She's just doing
fags. What grade do I get, Akko?
Oh, why did you get an A2? The last grades are done. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all so much for answering that question, for participating. The one thing I did want to say before we go to break is, what if we just left the phrase like that? So if we change the syntax, I feel like Ocean would appreciate this, but what if we said, on earth we are, and that's the end of it? Because he talks so much about being, to be, in this book. And so on earth we are, and then when you add kind of a comma, then you realize that we are is briefly gorgeous. And it's not briefly gorgeous. The fact that briefly gorgeous describes we are, not briefly gorgeous being what we are.
So, got you. That makes sense.
Anyway, that was a thought.
Well, I'm like looking at it, I have the book right here, and I'm just kind of like working around how all the words can fit. And it's so interesting that we are on earth means something very different from on earth we are. Like, even just moving around the words, it just changes the meaning so much. And I'm sure that he played around with that too, because where briefly gorgeous on earth is so different from on earth where briefly gorgeous.
Right.
Yeah, you're so right. We're briefly gorgeous on earth. It certainly doesn't hit as well either.
No. Because earth seems like an afterthought.
Yeah, in English linguistically, it's really interesting because what you put in the beginning of a sentence is what gets emphasized. And so on earth, as the first phrase that you read, it really hits you. Like, that's the highlight, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And maybe we're also used to the subject being at the beginning. So if you say we're briefly gorgeous on earth, we're still the focus. Whereas if you change the syntax, then we change who's the center. Mm-hmm. It's Earth and this whole experience. Ah, Ethan gets an A+ too. Look at that.
We all got A's. Love that.
And Akko gets an A for being such a great resident TA.
You get an A back.
Oh my God, it's great. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to do a summary. But after the summary, then we'll jump back into the discussion section.
Perfect. Can't wait.
We're back.
We are.
Woo. Okay. So Love Shelf will be back to join us in a moment. But right before we do that, we're going to give a summary of the second half of On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. Mm-hmm. So the second half starts off with Little Dog coming out to his mother. And he notes that saying he is gay in Vietnamese would have a far more negative connotation, having to do with like French imperialism, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So he tells her in Vietnamese that he doesn't like girls. And it's interesting because they're actually in a Dunkin' Donuts, which is a very East Coast tri-state thing for them to have been doing. As someone who once lived for a decent portion of her life on the East Coast, I have had many moderately deep conversations in the Dunkin' Donuts and have kind of some strangely fond memories there. Anyway,
this is really interesting because like I'm very much a Krispy Kreme girl. So like whenever like Dunkin' Donuts, I'm like those bready ass, insipid ass donuts. Like the coffee slaps, but everything else, throw it away. Just throw the whole franchise away. And I know y'all are typing in the comments. I know y'all are leaving hatred right now, but like we can have different perspectives. I mean, I just have taste, but you know, whatever. It's fine. It's like, Marcy, who are you coming for? Like, relax. Why are you popping off? Damn.
Oh my God. I will say, Krispy Kreme donuts, if I had to rate the two, I do think you've correctly stated the donuts are better. Krispy Kreme and the coffee is better at. Now they're like, turn it off. Everything else y'all have talked about this podcast
was fine. Throw the whole podcast away.
This is where we end, y'all.
Right.
So they're in the Dunkin' Donuts. Marcy is not there because Marcy hates Dunkin' Donuts. Akko's getting her life. But anyway, so Little Dog's mom then turns around and says she has something to tell him. And she tells him, by the way, just a quick trigger warning on what's about to happen next. So she tells him that she was forced to have an abortion by her husband and her family for her first child, who was going to be a boy as well. And she's actually quite haunted by it. She says she's seen him as a ghost, just looking at her. And she's very upset and distraught. She was like, I was only 17. Like, what? She feels a lot of guilt. And obviously, it's not her fault. And it's not something that she should have to carry as a burden, which she clearly does. Interspersed in this conversation, a Little Dog talks about his first crush and how he gave him a pizza bagel, which was very cute. But then
the crush gave Little
Dog
a pizza bagel, just for clarity.
Yes. The pizza bagel was exchanged from the crush.
I was like, doesn't fucking
type.
Matter? Like...
We gotta get these specificities out here. We don't know if it was pepperoni or sausage or just cheese. We don't know. But we know it was good.
Was it a vegan pizza bagel? We don't know. You know?
It certainly wasn't because it was 2000. And like, maybe it wasn't even 2000. So he ends up following him around, and so much that his crush gets annoyed with him, and he kind of talks about this kind of, you know, now I think about it, this makes sense because later it's this idea of validation from Trevor, but it's like wanting this validation, not getting this validation, being a kid, being out of sort, out of place, feeling out of place, etc. He talks about getting a pink bicycle, and it's like this kind of whole stream of consciousness memory lane thing, which is interrupted by his mom throwing up in the Dunkin' Donuts and them having to leave. It's actually interesting because it's we'll get into in this like juxtaposition of like beauty and then something kind of gross and then beauty and something kind of gross and them being mixed together as one thing. And anyway, so A few weeks later, he goes to hang out with Trevor in a barn, and he comes back with hay in his hair, and his mom kind of like pulls it out, kind of like you would with like a kid who you're like, did you just like go and get a mess all over your clothes? Right. Like, it was very...
Did you just play in the mud? Kind of, like, what the right. fuck?
Exactly. It's more like, I think it's kind of a moment of like him being like, this is her way of saying she accepts me as her son. You know, it was just a conversation about... not like coming out and acceptance, but not that not necessarily looking white entirely, but that not necessarily meaning a rejection. Does that entirely mean acceptance all the time for everyone? Probably not. But I think in this story, that was it was hinted at an acceptance. I could be reading that wrong.
I don't think you're reading that wrong. Yeah, I would agree.
Okay. So then we get a snippet of Trevor's father, and he's...
I think
the most... simple way would be to be say he's just terrible, but I think yeah, like he's just kind of very toxically masculine and kind of very sort of abusive towards Trevor. But I think of it being a little bit more descriptive, right, trying to exercise this lens thing that we're talking about, I would say he's kind of stuck in this idea of American whiteness and lost youth and the difference between his potential and his accomplishments. And he takes that out on Trevor, who is now about to become an adult and therefore like has all the quote unquote like privileges of being young and being like the person America most favors, which is a young white man. So I think there's that resentment and that anger and that like nostalgia for the past, etc. And Trevor just kind of resents him and is sort of dismissive to him, which I think then makes him more angry. But so that's the dynamic that's happening there. Then Little Dog gives kind of an anecdote about taking the bus and seeing things that neither Trevor nor his mom ever witness. I have thoughts about the way Little Dog talks about people in passing, but I'll get into that later.
Ooh,
but anyway,
come on.
Then we get more vignettes of Trevor and Little Dog together. And I think the gaze would be a very romantic gaze, I would say. Not even romantic as in loving, but romantic as like, you know, like if you can uglify something, can you beautify something or gorgeify something?
I think so. Yeah.
It's very, yeah, it's very... it's seen in a very warm, very, like if you were to describe it, it's like that part in a movie where like everyone's like running and laughing and it's like, ha, 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 ha. You know, it's, yeah, you know what I'm talking
about. Yeah, it's like this like idyllic kind of.
Yes.
Giving that very much like a best moment of, and it's like instead of like 2021,
yes.
It's like Trevor, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Or actually, okay, thank you. Is it 2022 right now? Who knows? Y'all know what I mean.
It's nostalgic sounding, which makes sense because in the beginning of part three, Little Dog is in New York now. And it looks like Trevor and him have kind of stopped seeing each other for the most part. Mm-hmm. And we get into... so remember in part one, we talked like kind of briefly about the drug use. They talked about it briefly in part one. Well, all the chickens have come to roost in part two.
Ciao.
Because now... yeah, Little Dog has noticed a lot of his friends have actually died of overdoses, and Trevor has also become addicted to drugs. And so there's this, so as Little Dog is going to New York and taking these classes in literature and writing, Trevor is sort of stuck in their hometown, kind of descending into this sort of sorrow.
The reason why, you know, Little Dog... So Little Dog is going to Brooklyn College. I think he's studying, like, poetry? Literature? Something like that. And he actually came back because Trevor actually died of an overdose. The original plan was to kind of come back. And so we're seeing, for example, Little Dog, like, texting, like, mutual friends of him and Trevor and, like, them being like, oh, my God, like, I can't believe this happened. But it's also, like, Trevor's, like, the eighth of, you know, several people who've also kind of met a similar fate. And so there's sort of this examination of, like, how we got here. And so we see, for example, that, like, Trevor, he was addicted to like, I think it was specifically fentanyl and oxycodone because he had, like, I think he had broken his ankle or something like that when he was, like, 15. And, like, basically, his doctor was like, oh, you should, like, take oxycodone because, like, that'll help with, like, pain relief and stuff, and sort of didn't really, you know, it's highly addictive, right? And so, like, and also Trevor is like 15, right? So like, so at that developmental mm-hmm. stage, like the propensity for addiction is just a lot higher. And so like, it just kind of spiraled out of control. And so, and that is what sort of led to eventual heroin, fentanyl use and things like that. And so we actually see that this actually wasn't even the first time that Trevor overdosed, but like the other mm-hmm. time Little Dog was there and like, you know, was able to like get a medical attention and stuff. And so it's just been one of those things where like, it was sort of a slow decline, and we don't necessarily know why. We could presume that Trevor and Little Dog kind of stopped being involved with each other because Little Dog left, but like I think there's also a piece here around maybe just like Little Dog seeing Trevor's deteriorating health and kind of seeing the ways in which, like, you know, the drug abuse sort of took over his life. I think perhaps there was some distancing there as well. So just like,
do you mind if I mm-hmm. well, there's a couple of things I want to mention. Little Dog is basically, so we're in an opioid crisis in America. And if we're really being honest, we've been in a drug crisis since like the 70s when the government definitely flooded crack into the black suburbs and black areas of America. Mm-hmm. And there's like, basically we've had two waves. We've had one that was focused on people of color, in which people of color were highly criminalized and penalized for addiction and the government was terrible. Mm-hmm. Just to the community. And then we have the second wave where the faces of addiction is now more white. And it's true that started mostly with OxyContin mm-hmm. in the late 90s. And now we're at a peak. It's a very bad peak. Mm-hmm. And the difference is a sympathy right. in the popular imagination towards white people with this addiction. But I will note that sympathy has not come with an excessively large amount of assistance. It's come with a lack of penalization and a lack of jail time and a lack of destruction, extra destruction of the community by the government. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't come with actual tangible assistance. And if we're on like 20 years now, it's actually a very large crisis. So just wanted to point those two things out. Back to Marcy.
Oh, definitely. And thank you for that, because it is getting a little bit into my personal life. But I used to work in public health, and like that was just like an ongoing conversation of like, okay, all of a sudden now it's an opioid crisis. Okay, mm-hmm. now we need to care about it. Now there's research on it. Now there's, you know, public attention on this, when it's like, you know, black communities of color have been devastated by yep. drug abuse for a very long time. And so it's just very, yeah, that's not lost on me at all. I'm not sure if the book goes into all that, but yeah. That's
and
just,
I actually want to talk about that too. But I think he's much more sympathetic to the opioid crisis as it affects white Americans now than he is. I don't think he thinks about that piece, about the effect it's had on black people. And I would just like to point out, for a long time, people didn't even believe that the government had a part to play in the drug crisis that black Americans faced in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. Now people will say, like, yeah, they did do that to help. It's this ridiculous thing. The idea was like, we're going to sell these drugs to help fund like people fighting communism in South and Latin America, which isn't really to be honest, it's part of the Cold War. Like, mm-hmm. right, this idea of defeating communism in South and Latin America, and it's all part of the same Cold War that affects Little Dog, that affects all of Vietnam and Korea. And the Cold War was not cold at all yeah. for some people. It was it was very real and very alive. So now, you know, we'll say that these big pharma companies are responsible for the opioid epidemic. But I think if you'd said in early 2000s that the government had any responsibility for the drug epidemic plaguing minority communities, people would tell you that you were being conspiratorial. Right. And now that's a proven fact. So it's not even just lack of sympathy. It's a lack of belief and penalization. Right. Okay, footnotes finished.
Yeah.
Mercy.
So literally all of that. What were we talking about? Oh, yes. So like, this is kind of gently being, you know, talking about the opioid crisis, all of that. And mm-hmm. I'm going to just say this right now. Part two was giving poetry, y'all. When I tell you, it was so lyrical. It just oh, my God. So in talking about this, like, you know, there's also Little Dog writes a lot about sort of like the intersection of like the arts and how it can be very prescriptive, and like sort of his experience like studying literature and writing, how like there's like people feel like writing has to be a very specific way, has to have a very specific form. Kind of bringing in themes of like toxic masculinity, like syntax, PTSD. There's like a lot of shit going on, and it's like if it sounds mm-hmm. jumbled, it's because it low-key kind of was, but like it read really beautifully and like all kind of came together. Anyway, so we're kind of seeing this happening, whatever. So 7 months after Trevor dies, we see that Lon, Little Dog's grandmother, is also dying. So we see sort of the beginnings mm-hmm. of her being diagnosed. She was already living with schizophrenia, but like she was later diagnosed with like stage 4 bone cancer. She was kind of in denial about it the entire time, but like Little Dog, Mai, his aunt, and his mom. His mom's name is Rose, by the way. I don't know if that was like a thing in part one, but like we learn her name is Rose in part two, so I'm just going to call her Rose now. So we see that they're kind of like, you know, mourning and trying to accept the slow death that Lon is about to experience. Well, actually, not even that slow, really, because like after she was diagnosed, they were like, yeah, you have maybe 3 weeks, maybe. So just kind of like dealing with that. And so like as Little Dog is sort of like navigating that situation, he's, again, going back to the memories of Trevor, like he gets a bunch of flashbacks of like Trevor, and like there's actually a flashback that goes into the first time like they had sex, mm-hmm. or I guess like anal penetrative sex, and like it was a very wild ride, and I just want to take a second to talk about it. So basically what happened was that the two were like at the barn that they were like that they worked at or whatever, I guess it was, yeah, like part of the fields that they used to work. And essentially, like, they were, like, in the barn, like, chilling or whatever. And then, essentially, like, Trevor was like, we should have sex. And, like, Little Dog was like, okay. And so, like, we can talk about this more in the discussion section. But basically, so Trevor was like, I'm going to be the top in this situation. And instead of using lube or, you know, anything that would make this comfortable for you, I'm going to just spit on my dick and just hope that that's enough lubricant for you okay with. Which, personally, I don't know how Little Dog didn't pass out. Like, that. Like honestly, that sounded absolutely just, oh, God. Anyway, but basically, after a while, he, like, Little Dog's into it, whatever. They're like, having sex. 10 minutes later, essentially, like, Little Dog, like, you know, bodies taking place, you know. Basically, Little Dog, like, you know, gets shit on Trevor's dick and, like, you know, is mortified and it's like, oh my God, I cannot believe this happened. Trevor is, like, acting weird about it. They end up going to this, like, river to, like, I guess, like, wash up. And Little Dog adopts... What's that?
I think, so his internal monologue goes off, right? Like, anytime, mm-hmm. like, kind of like if you, like, when you were, I don't know, if you were a kid and you ever wet your bed or, like, were in public and, like, or if you're a person who has a period and you've ever had like your period in public, mm-hmm. you know, that feeling of just like complete shame and embarrassment.
Yeah.
And like, and then if you are a person of color, like sometimes if you've had bad experiences in white spaces in particular, like all these like feelings of like fear and like, oh my God. And so his inner monologue is really as it would for anyone. Mm-hmm. Like he's like, Trevor's gonna hate me, this is, you know, it just goes into this whole place, and then Trevor's actually not that bad in this situation. Okay, so
yeah, like you know, they go to the river, they like wash up. At one point, like Trevor starts like eating Little Dog's ass and it's just like, it's okay, like we're good. Like it was just like this whole thing. So it was personally, I don't know why this came up specifically with Lon's whole situation. I didn't necessarily see the through line. What's up?
I think it's like it goes back to kind of like Rose throwing up at Dunkin' Donuts after telling this like story about it's this mixture of things. It goes back to like what is gorgeous, right? When life is both terrible and ugly and other things are beautiful. So like there's this moment of beauty. And it's true. There's so many times in your life when something like super beautiful is happening and then just something totally gross or like not cool happens. And like we talk about the beautiful parts, right? But like since we're human, things are both beautiful and gross. And so Lon is, when he describes his grandmother passing away, it's really physically, I guess someone would say gross. Like her body parts are turning black, like she's in a lot of pain. Her body's deteriorating as she lives.
Mm-hmm.
But Lon is so much to him and her life is beautiful. And it wouldn't be it wouldn't be honest to say that this body deteriorating is all she is. Like, it is, but it wouldn't be honest to say she's only all the memories and beautiful things, because dying is also a part of life. So I think that's what he's doing. He's trying to show, just because something gross happens in a beautiful moment doesn't mean, it doesn't make someone less gorgeous. And I think that, especially in part of oppression and isms, all the isms, racism, sexism, homophobia, is to make things gross, to take away value. You know, your disgust can be weaponized, right? And I think that's what he's trying to say. And this idea of like whiteness as purity, and like if certain things are pure, then other things are impure and gross and dirty. But actuality, there is no purity and there's no grossness, or maybe there are, they're both there, but they're not separate. Right. The dichotomy is not there. They're all one in life. Anyway, that's what I think was trying to be conveyed to us.
Got you. That makes a lot of sense. No, because yeah, there's definitely parallels for sure, in how, you know, caring for Lon in her last 2 weeks. Yeah, it was a similar kind of visceral experience. But we'll talk about that more. This idea of like disgust and beauty kind of like existing at the same time, because there's a lot of that theme sort of here. But just to kind of wrap up, you know, essentially we see that Lon dies shortly thereafter. Rose, my little dogs, everyone's pretty devastated. They end up burying her back in Saigon, where little dog is like with Rose, and he's able to sort of like grieve with her and everything. We also see Paul, his like, technically not his grandfather, but like his grandfather, you know, also kind of being, he wasn't there, but like, you know, he had like, I guess, Skyped in to like the funeral proceedings and sort of his mourning too. So we're just sort of seeing everyone's kind of like mourning, trying to figure everything out. We see some flashbacks about like little dog's dad, who's like abusive. It wasn't really that big a thing, but basically he was like kind of like, there's a lot of just like processing taking place. There was actually a really interesting scene where like when they were in Saigon, like right after, like I think it was like the same day that they had the funeral for Lon, little dog like came across this like party outside where basically like there was someone who had, like, he didn't know any of these people, but there was someone who had recently died, and like next to the, like, the person's body was like still there, and like there was like a small circle of people mourning that person, but like around this person there was like a bunch of like drag performers, and it was like this huge party, and like kids are running around. It's like 2 a.m. like it's like this whole party situation, like people are like, and you talked about how it was like essentially, I don't know what the name of it is, but it's essentially like this custom where folks like, it's like a delaying of sadness where it's like, okay, this person died, but we're gonna like really be jovial and like celebrate, not that this person is dead, but sort of celebrating the legacy of like a life, so to speak. It was really, really beautiful, and I feel like that's something that, like, I don't know, that scene really touched me, and I was like, this is very nice. But anywho, did anything else happen? Boop, 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 boop. Oh, not really. Basically, like, it's just like little dog.
The ending is.
Yeah, so
I can't with you.
Yeah, so little dog is essentially just like processing these deaths. It's like there's like time is all over the place. It like skips forward a little bit, and basically we see like a scene where like he's talking to Rose, and like basically she's telling him the story of like the story about like where Lon, like, you know, was holding Mai and like in front of all those soldiers from part one, and like they were like eating the brains of like a monkey. And then there was like this image of like essentially there's been this whole theme this whole time that we didn't really talk about, of like buffaloes running off of cliffs. Like that just like came up a lot in part two. So the book literally ends with like this image of like buffaloes running towards a cliff, but then turning into dogs, but then like falling off, but then becoming like butterflies and like flying off into like the middle distance. I don't know. It was a whole roller coaster. We were just along for the ride, and little dog is processing the future, and we were right alongside him, chilling,
processing,
just becoming butterflies, and, you know, washing ourselves in rivers, and I don't know, being vegan. So.
Yeah, there's this whole thing about veal. Okay, I think part of this is you just have to read You just have to read. Like, this isn't, this is going to be hard for us to summarize. Well, hey, we gave it a, we gave it a college try.
I think we gave it at the very least a, at least mediocre try. Like,
oh, this is a B on an exam for
at,
sure.
We but at least passed. Y'all got at least the gist. Right? Okay.
Yeah, it's true. This is, look, we said this was a spark notes. The point is, to get the real feeling and the depth of it, you probably should read it. So.
Exactly. But yeah, so now I guess let's take a break, and then we come back. We will get into all the thoughts and feelings, and we'll be rejoined by our friends from Left Shelf and get into it.
Woo! And we're back.
Yes, we are. And our friends are back.
No way. Yes. We're still here.
It's like we never left.
Yeah.
Right. Like, wow.
Yeah. I'm so dead. Well, we always say, like, this is the funnest part about having a book club is that we get to talk to other people, and it's always more book clubby when there's other people around. So yeah. We're very excited. So we wanted to ask y'all, what is kind of your first or your final impressions of the book?
I guess I'll go first. So I sent pages. Whenever we read books, I'll send like text after text after text to Nino, and then I will get it to her at like 1 a.m. and she won't answer me. And I'm like, please, please answer. I talked a lot about this book. This book was really challenging for me because I think on the one hand, it's like a masterpiece. I really, really, really loved it. And then on the other hand, I felt as though Ocean and the narrator, even though they come from a completely different background than I do, like the things that their eyes catch are the same types of things that my eyes catch. And like when I write, the things that he's looking at and the ways in which he looks at them kind of reminded me of what I am attempting to do in like my own writing and my own artistic process. And so I felt like I was like maybe giving him a hard time because I was going through like line by line being like, oh, would I have seen it like that? Oh, this is interesting. So I don't know. I was just very challenged by this book in that way. I think that as an author who puts words together in interesting ways, he's amazing that you can really tell that he's a poet, and he's really unashamed. Like there are things that he would say in his novel that even if, I mean, because this is somewhat auto-fictional, it's hard to tell exactly where fiction ends and he begins, but the things that he's open to talking about and the ways and the kind of sincerity that he puts forth in every word, it's almost like embarrassing as a reader. You feel as though you're entering some private room that you like you've been given a key to, but when you walk in it still feels like maybe you shouldn't be there almost. So yeah, so I felt like very amazed. And then I mean, I'm gonna bring in some kind of outside information, but like listening to him talk, the way that he's so like gentle in his talking versus the openness that he writes this book is very like, I don't know. It just, it like made me very tense as a reader. It was kind of hard for me to place whether or not like I admired it. I was like jealous of it. I was confused by it. I don't know. This book like really made me feel a lot of things just because this is an author really bearing his soul for the audience. So I don't know. I just think that that's really like hard to find in art, to find a person who is so interested in giving up who he is for people to take, that he feels as though, I guess, that he is enough, that even when he gives away so much on the page, he can like pull himself back from it. I don't know. I just felt like that was very overwhelming to me as a reader.
That is so interesting. That is really, really interesting because, well, I'll just kind of start with my general impressions and then sort of respond to that. So, I really like the book. I thought it was like, I mean, part two especially, I felt like was just, I mean, it felt like a fever dream at points. Like there was like, I mean, Literally, I was finishing it yesterday and I was like, there were parts where I was like, I don't even know what's happening anymore, but I'm just like kind of along for the ride. And it was just like really lovely, like just to kind of be like taken by the words on the page and still have it make sense. It's not like I was like lost or like had no idea what was going on, but it was just like the way that like the thoughts would just so quickly be interrupted by like another thought or like another scene. And like, it was just like, it was kind of chaotic, honestly, but there was sort of like something stringing it all together that I just thought was really, really lovely. And in the language, it was fascinating because I felt like it felt like the book was almost like, I don't know if I want to say the book was like bilingual in a sense or was like code switching in a sense, but there were moments where it was kind of like it read like, oh, we, this poetry literature, like we are getting into it. And then there were other moments where like Little Dog would use certain words or like we kind of talked about this in part one with the whole like crackhead thing and stuff like that, where it was almost like you're kind of like speaking to two different audiences, or like there was this whole interception about what are we playing football? Like, there was like a piece where like he was talking about how a bunch of people would say like, you know, what's good in the neighborhood, right? Which is something I want to kind of unpack. There's a lot I want to say about that actually, but just things like that where it was kind of like, okay, this is interesting that both of these are happening at the same time. And it was interesting because Ethan, to your point, it was very intimate and like just very open, and reading it I was kind of like, it did make me more fascinated who Ocean was like as a person in a way that I don't think I felt with other authors, where it's kind of like, this is like, I don't know what is real and what isn't, and so I feel like I just like want to see more of like who you are as a person. But in that, I'm kind of like, you know, I think this book does a really good job at challenging like so many paradigms of like where power actually lies and things like that. So for instance, like Little Dog's relationship with Trevor and how like Trevor is seen as this like more masculine, like, you know, sexually dominant, quote unquote, type of person that like might be afforded power, but like kind of the book really challenges like where power can lie. And so I was thinking like in the idea of like really showcasing one's life, being so open, being so vulnerable, just showing so many intimate details, like, does that have to mean like, you know, a giving up or a diminishment or a nakedness almost? Mm-hmm. Like, is it almost like there's like a power in that too? It just made me think a lot about power. That though, was just really, really interesting. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I also thought that just the style of this book was quite political, because I was reading a bunch of Goodreads reviews after finishing the book, and also talking to Ethan about this. And a lot of reviews were saying how this is very lyrical and poetic, but it doesn't hold enough plot. So it's not necessarily like interesting, or it doesn't really captivate you, or it's hard to read after like the first 50 pages.
Damn.
And, yeah. And that's like, people say that. Yeah. And like, okay. Roxanne Gay gave a similar review where she was like, you know, it's absolutely gorgeous, some lines really gutted me, but you know, it's not enough to like hold you for a novel. But when I read it, I don't know, I just thought just the style of writing was extremely political. First of all because I think Ocean Vuong did not conform to like this typical American novel style. And I listened to him talk in several interviews, and he mentioned how in a lot of publishing rooms, like, they would point that out, and he would be like, no, this is my book. This is how I want to tell the story. And so he really pushed back against that, and he wanted to keep all of the kind of lyricism, and he wanted the book to be the way it was. So I thought just like the process of that was pretty political. On top of that, I know it's like an epistolary book, like it's a letter to his mom, but it's also more of a stream of consciousness. So in that sense, like, to have the stream of consciousness, like the presence of an immigrant, of an Asian person, be the main subject of a book, I thought in and of itself was really political. And then in terms of style, the parallels it drew, the way it communicated its thoughts, I thought was also really powerful in a way to like portray trauma. I'm not sure if either of you have seen the movie Palo Alto. It's like an old movie, but there's like the scene where trigger warning for sexual abuse, but there's this scene where this girl gets abused, and it's shot in this way where like only pieces of her, like her hairline or her eye or like her finger, are shown to really visualize the disassociation people feel sometimes, and like the parts, like the disparate parts in which they like see themselves not as a whole but as these like pieces of things. And I thought that this book did such a like tender and beautiful job of like portraying that process of trauma at these very different levels, and then trying to find the joy in it. So for me, this book was very touching. But yeah, I really liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, just kind of jumping off of that point at first. So I did feel, Ethan, your feelings of overwhelmedness. And then, like you said, some feelings of embarrassment and some feelings of like, oh my God, someone's let me into a room that I should close the door. Mm-hmm. Like I should walk out of the room. And I think there's something there about, I think Ocean has seen a lot of things that disgust people and has been an object of people's disgust. I don't know how familiar anyone is with bullying in their life personally, but when you've been the object of disgust, anything that in your life has been a trauma, you either like run away from it. The other process is an acceptance of it. I think he's doing this process of, what if I made disgust and shame like my friend or a phenomenon I had a conversation with. And I was like, that's really hard, I think, especially for us as Americans, because we shy away from shame and disgust so much, because shame and disgust is what we use to oppress, right? We make things disgusting and shameful, and then we use that to oppress. So we ourselves have a bad relationship with things that are gross or disgusting, right? And it made me think he's doing that. And I was like, that's the reason it feels so uncomfortable for me, because this is not a paradigm that we live in. And then it made me ask, why don't we live in it? And why don't we think it's beautiful? Like, why can't someone be dying and be beautiful? Like, why do we put things in the corner and hush them away? Kind of like Giovanni's room. So... Yeah. So sorry, we just read Giovanni's room. And there's like, everyone's like, okay, sure, yeah, kind of like Giovanni.
I got you.
Yeah, we just read, and there's a part where Giovanni talks about the room they're in being like gross and disgusting, but also a freedom, yeah. So that was something that I was having a conversation with the book in my mind about, and that was really interesting for me. And then the other thing, at first, I was like, okay, this ending has taken a direction that's like a little bit more less structure. And then I thought about it again, and I was like, well, the beginning is the furthest point from where he is now, is his youth. And he's, you know, his early 30s. So he's digested that part the most. So his consciousness has an idea of how that fits. And the middle part, where he's a teenager, it seems to get a little less structured because it's a little closer to the present. But his consciousness has also moderately processed that, at least it has a beginning and an end. But the last part is him now, or him very, very recently. And so his consciousness is less structured because he hasn't finished processing the now. And Nino, to your point, to do a stream of consciousness with a non-white person, because there are stream of consciousness with white folks. I think, what's the one? Ulysses is the famous one.
Yeah.
Ulysses.
Yeah.
Who?
You.
Yeah. Ulysses is like...
Okay.
But I've never read it, Marcy.
Ethan and I just read this book called Outline by Rachel Cusk, which was kind of like that too.
Yes, that is another one, yeah.
That is, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, so stream of consciousnesses are things that happen, but I think you're right, Nino, to make a queer Asian man who we are in his consciousness, and you're basically following him, not just following him as a protagonist, but you're in his mind. I think that's where he's forcing the reader to have, forcing is a strong word. Like you said, he's very gentle. Yeah. He's allowing the reader into his consciousness. And in that, we can be more connected to someone who we don't even know. And I think you're right. There's a strength there to say, like, could you allow someone into your consciousness and let them really know you? And in doing that, allow them to know themselves. And you're like, whoo. Yeah. We all could. Yeah. But
yeah. That's something I love about writing as a whole, because I think it allows you to enter someone's consciousness in the way no other form really does. Because I feel like movies are, they do take this like omniscient third person lens, right? But writing, you can really tell the truth as you see it, as a person, and also how that truth may not be compatible with how other things you see, or that truth can change. And so I really love this book for that.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. And you know, now that I'm thinking about it, there's a line he says at the end of the second half, where he says, like, when Houdini was like, couldn't get out of a trap he was in and wasn't able to make it, and his wife kissed him and passed him the key to his freedom. Mm. And he says, that to me is the meaning of love. And at first I was like, it took me a second to digest that. But then I'm realizing this whole book is, he's saying, like, if we're in a trap, this act of love of writing this is a key to our own, like, I don't know, maybe freedom is a strong word, but I think so. Like, all the things that we trap ourselves in are like restrictions or limitations. Like, he's saying, if I write this, this is a key. If I give you my consciousness, it's a key to your consciousness.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh. That's a very loving thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm even thinking about the whole veal metaphor that kept showing up in part two, where I don't know if we mentioned this in the plot summary, which we literally just did, so why do I not remember this? But like, basically, like, in talking about Trevor, Little Dog was talking about how, you know, he like ate beef, but he never ate veal because he thought that the way that veal was prepared was cruel, because like these calves were like forced into these boxes and like just sort of like fattened up, and like the only instance of freedom they knew was when they were like taken out of their cage to then be slaughtered and then eaten. So it was like, it's just like such a brief blip. And I feel like there was a lot around this idea of like just being contained, or like this imprisonment, or like where exactly do the bars lay around our own lives? Like, are they immediately next to us? Are they like further off in the distance? That kind of gives us the idea that like maybe they're not there, even if they are. And I love what you're saying as far as like this kind of truth, this vulnerability being perhaps a key out of this. And I find it interesting that like a lot of the forms of, like, I think about, for instance, like, you know, there was a lot of mention of like birds and butterflies, and like I think other animals that we tend to associate with this idea of freedom. And I just find it interesting that like to point to that idea was to point to something that wasn't human. That was something I'm still trying to like parse my ideas and thoughts around. But yeah, it's just very, very interesting.
I have something off topic I want to share, but I do want to continue about the animal metaphor. I was very curious, because he mentions a few times in the book the buffalo run. Mm-hmm. That metaphor was very curious to me. Nino, did I send you a text about that? I think I did, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, like,
Nino was like, yes.
I was like, I definitely saw it. Yes.
Because, like, the buffalo run isn't a natural process. It's, like, engineered by humans in order to, like, mass kill animals. So it's weird that he uses the buffalo run as this natural process, that when Trevor and Little Dog are talking about it, it's as though it's this process by which buffalo just follow one another off the edge. I would assume, just because this book is so meticulously researched otherwise, that Ocean didn't think that buffalo runs were just this natural process, that he's actually purposefully having his characters kind of talk about like false information in order to make a point. Because that metaphor appears multiple places. I don't know if anyone had like a more complete reading of that than I did. That's just like one of the things that I was really thinking about a lot, like the intentionality behind like the misreading of that process.
That's a good point. And I actually think, oh no, Akka's gonna give a criticism. Not because I don't think the book is beautiful. I do. I think there are times where he doesn't entirely get them. I for me, I've noticed it the most when it had to do with things regarding blackness. But I think this is a similar situation where he uses something to make a point, but I don't think he's thought deeply enough about that point. So I would actually say he probably did think it was natural. Or if he didn't, he was more about the effect of it, of the idea of them running and together and falling together. Yeah.
Well, so then that kind of leads into this other thing I wanted to mention. He's very interested in this way of writing that I'm also very interested in that I don't see very often. So I thought that I was cool, but it turns out that he is even cooler. but this kind of open interest in the paths of things and the ways in which they intersect with one another, that he, when he talks about like oxycodone and things like that, he's interested in giving us the background of what it actually is and like writing about these things, these concepts, these animals, these drugs, these people as these discrete things that are all given their own histories. And then like the interest of the book is when these two histories, like let's say Oxy and Trevor, who like haven't interacted for like 15 years, kind of come together and like the ways in which the histories of one kind of inform the histories of the other. I don't know, it feels very materialist, I want to say. I don't want to go so far as to say leftist because I don't really know, but I think that in American writing, because like everyone is an individual without a past, in America, oftentimes, like, you don't get this sense of history as a process of conscious material choices that then interact with one another. And he's very interested in that concept. Like, the ways in which our past, not just as people, but, like, the past of the earth and the past of objects, like, also, like, they also come together in ways to then tell us more about like who we are as people.
So then your point earlier about maybe he did know about the human aspect of the buffalo, because that would be this humans like had an effect on nature and that nature then has an effect on what it is. So your point is like the human influence becomes part of nature. And that maybe when we think of Earth, we think of just the planet. But if we are also part of Earth, then what we do becomes the natural. So, and then it informs us. So like the, just for your point about Trevor, like the decision by Big Pharma to get into this Oxycontin thing, it stops being just like an individual decision and becomes a building block. And then that building block becomes a phenomenon or a wave. And that wave takes on over a bunch of people. And I think you're right, because he's thinking about his life in his youth with the Vietnam War. It's the same thing. Like a bunch of people somewhere else made a decision. That decision becomes a building block. And then that's a whole phenomenon that overtakes a bunch of people the same way a wave would. Not because no one's responsible, people are responsible, but because the effect of it is so large, similar to like a huge phenomenon, like a natural phenomenon. That's a really good point, Ethan. I really like that. Or maybe that wasn't your point.
It's almost, I kind of wonder if like Ocean's interested in playwriting, because it almost is kind of, I think the way that playwrights oftentimes look at their work is that you have to set like a scene completely for the audience to like view it. So if like if you're kind of really interested in that craft, I think that you imbue the objects by which the characters like live amongst as these pieces of a past that then intersect with the characters throughout the course of the play. And so there were times in this piece where it felt like that he's giving us these objects, like placing them in our eyesight and like telling us where they come from, so that we can then see like when another character picks it up, like we can see these like material realities come together in this new way, in this new different way.
Yeah,
I really agree. So there's this quote in the first part of the book that reads, "I'm 28 years old, 5'4" tall, 112 pounds. I am handsome at exactly three angles and deadly from everywhere else. I'm writing you from inside a body that used to be yours, which is to say, I am writing as a son. And I just thought that line was really powerful. And I thought it illuminated a lot of the like ways that the book was structured, because it is like written to his mother, but she also doesn't speak English and is illiterate. And in this quote, he says he's writing to someone that he kind of came out of. And so I interpret that as like, as a more general you of the earth, of the history that kind of affected him. And that is continuing to like affect the future, which you, Marcy and Akko, talked about in your last episode as well. So I thought that whole awareness was there, and that that you was kind of speaking to all things living, because in the book, Little Dog mentions how a lot of his friends are dead, how Lan is dead. And so he's writing to his mother because I think partially because she's still alive and maybe she can't read it, but there's a potential she could, like someone's listening. So it kind of felt like this book was kind of written to, through this non-linear way, disperse these events and kind of see the picture as a whole and then find purpose behind that story in the aftermath. I don't know if you've seen Arrival or read Your Life and Other Stories by Ted Chiang, but it's kind of the same idea where it's like you can look at you can look at events in this causal way, in this linear way, or you can look at, you can see the beginning and the end and then try to see what forces like got you there. And it kind of felt like this book did this this book had those same parallels when it, where it talked about these specific events sometimes out of order and looked at the whole picture, like already knowing what had happened and what had transpired, and looking at these like maximizing and minimizing forces of like profits, for example, with in terms of drugs or like violence and how it spreads. And I thought in that regard it was also quite political and very illuminating, subversive?
You know, I love what you just said as far as like kind of having a sort of a beginning point and end point that go in separate directions, and like we're just kind of pointing to different micro and macro events like throughout. And it's making me even just think about the idea of focusing so much on the earth, because like when you were saying all of that and just sort of throughout this conversation, I've just been thinking about like, like say if we look at Little Dog's life as like sort of like a central point, I'm almost getting this image of like sort of the context around, you know, like Big Pharma, Vietnam War, like all these different things almost existing sort of in orbit sort of around his life. Like I'm like, I feel like there's a symbolism here in talking about the earth being spherical, rotational, sort of like things kind of existing in orbit. I feel like there's like a, there's a rotation motion here that I'm getting that
non-linear.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of speaking to that like non-linearity and everything there. And so not sure if that was intentional, but that's definitely something that I'm kind of like sitting in and I literally have not thought about like, until this moment. So I'm just curious.
Marcy, do you mind if I pirouette off your point?
That's because totally fine. Sashay off my point.
I like am picking up what you're putting down because in my mind, remember last time we talked about a Big Bang? And the thing about the Big Bang is there's no like point where the universe starts, right? Like the universe is, and every part is exactly the same, like this there was and then there wasn't. And so if you think of people or our lived experiences as linearly, that's one vector. But what if you thought of our experience as a universe? And so each time point you is a is like a place you can go to. So the way he's like conceptualizing his story, I mean it is partially linear, but I think he's deconstructing that so that like there it's almost like places you can visit, or he's deconstructing time itself and asking you like a human experience isn't linear, it's a shape or it's a bang. And all points of it can be looked at. And when we look at it linearly, like this caused this to happen, then we give it a definition and a meaning. And that meaning can make it gross or ugly or, and maybe that's fine, but maybe it's also inaccurate. Maybe it's not as descriptive as it could be. And so, you know, to your point, like I'm writing as someone who was once you, that is to say, that's what we call a son. But if we change our conception of it, it means that we are all just an extension of the person before us, and therefore like the extension of the whole planet and the whole consciousness around us. And that's such a different way of thinking about ourselves, as opposed to Ethan, your point, like you said, about individualism, right? And so then we become all the things that happened. It's such a cool breakdown now that I'm thinking about it. And he says another point. I think this is how he also grieves his grandmother and comes to peace with it, because he's saying, like, I can write this and maybe one day you'll be reincarnated as some other consciousness who will read this, not even knowing it's about you and me and us. And then you'll see the bigger picture that you didn't even get to see while you're alive. And there was something, it made me wonder, like, is there something in my life that I'm seeing that someone did so long ago? You know, that I needed to see now? Yeah. And you think at first that that's kind of a stretch, but then you wonder, for all just consciousness, maybe it's not. Like, anyway, it's really cool to think about. So
we should all take a BuzzFeed quiz to determine who we were in our past lives.
Genghis Khan. I don't want to like take over your show, but I would love for you guys, because you kind of hinted at it, I feel like this book is very challenging in terms of its conceptualization of identities, that I felt a lot of tension that I would be willing to talk about in a bit, about like the gay aspects of the book. But I felt uncomfortable sometimes, weirded out, challenged with his depiction of Black bodies in this piece. But I feel as though I don't quite grasp why, and you had hinted at it earlier. I would love to hear you guys talk a little bit about that, if that's...
Oh, look at that transition. Wonderfully done. Akko taking notes, like... I guess I could start. And I think, I mean, to Marcy, I think, discussed this pretty well and picked up on it in the first part of this. And I think we were both like, in the first part, we're like, we think this is here, but we're not sure. And I think in the second part, I can say I'm pretty sure. I don't think his examination or the fullness in which he views other people, I don't think he brings that same awareness to Black people in this book. For instance, when I was reading it, I was like, you've never described Trevor or any of your friends who were opioid addicts, which, and I agree that you shouldn't, as crackheads. Like, you just, those words never really came out of your mouth. You made sure, like, a dedicated effort to make them more, or at least Trevor more. And then, and so there's a time when he was on the bus and he was talking about someone who was trans, and I felt like it was very, not dismissive, but still very like, I'm just watching a scene happen. And the same thing with the "you're good" line. I was like, I think you're misunderstanding what "you're good" means. I mean, as a concept, like, "you're good" has two different meanings in the Black community, and when white people say it, I think, I could be wrong.
Correct.
And I think he used the phrases and the terms, but I don't think he thought about their depth. And I actually think throughout this book, and I think this is a problem is a strong word, an oversight that a lot of people have as immigrants. That's even a kind of a general word, but Blackness is intrinsically part of America. And not just part of it, it is a conscious culture in existence that is completely interwoven. It's not taught in schools. It's not really discussed, but it influences everything. Same thing with Indigenous people, same thing with every people. But in the American perception, it's just set pieces. When in actuality, like, it is a consciousness you know, it's people, individual people, but also it's a consciousness, and it informs the American landscape. And I don't think he completely understands that or weaves that in or examines that, because, like we said, kind of in the first half, he's kind of in the American miasma and therefore the American paradigm, which diminishes Black blackness is, and doesn't allow blackness to have a perspective that might even inform him of more about himself and his experience is there. And I think he kind of sees it sometimes, like with the Tiger Woods thing in the church, but he just doesn't go into it enough. And it's not my favorite part of the book. I think it's the part that I think I dislike. Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of going with that, Akka, thank you for saying that. I definitely certainly agree as far as the set piece situation. Like that part of the, we talked about this briefly in the plot summary, but like, you know, where, you know, Little Dog's talking about like, oh, all these areas of Hartford that like, you know, you never really saw. It was just sort of like black people were kind of like, just like,
placed,
like bodies to like provide almost like background decorations to like provide like a certain meaning of like, okay, like a black trans body being here. What is that? Like, what does that communicate about the space that now
exactly
that like is here, right? Like what are we using blackness as a proxy to communicate? And so I feel like that was something that was brought up. And something that was also really interesting to me was that like, it was really interesting because like reading the what's good part, I don't know, that part kind of, I was like, I feel like this could have gotten chopped because like I was just like,
I agree.
Reading it, I was like, it was so weird because I'm like, okay, what's good? I'm like, that's, I don't associate that with white people saying that. And it was very interesting because like as we were going along, I thought there was gonna be any kind of mention of like, oh, this, you know, like this is, there's like a very specific procedure where like, you know, language originates in black communities. It kind of becomes like visible within sort of like a white cultural gaze, and then in that it's like denigrated or made fun of, or it's like used as like a form of capital to be like youthful or cool, quote unquote, but then like is seen as illegitimate and like something disposable, right? And so I thought there was gonna, that was going to come in, but like it didn't. And I was like, yikes. And what was interesting, and I think with the 50 Cent piece, I know we talked about that in the first part, but like I think that was kind of something that came up a lot as well. And one thing I just thought was really fascinating was that like in the scenes where there are black people, like it is just fundamentally different. Like, you know, I'm thinking about the scenes with like the black church. I'm even thinking about the brief scene in part two where Little Dog was talking about going to like, I think it was Junior's family's like house for Thanksgiving. And they were like listening to Etta James, and like within sort of like that music, like he was able to like, you know, it brought up images of like his grandmother and like, you know, his own life. And like there was just, in like one of the uncles was like, oh, like, what do you know about Etta James? And it was like this whole situation. And it was like, and it's just funny because it's like in those vignettes that we're seeing, it's kind of like black people are, there's an immediate acceptance or like a willingness to understand, or like just like a, like a, just like a lifting up that's happening. Like I feel like in these spaces with black people, like Little Dog is able to like understand, like exactly to your point, Akko, like parts of himself, but simultaneously there's sort of like that lack of labor to sort of like do that in tow to understand them, right?
Exactly.
Like, and I think that's the part that I'm kind of like,
it's irritating. This is,
and it's especially when you see like Little Dog puts in work to break down like Trevor's psychology to like be legible within like those spaces, and like even in spaces with black folks where like there it would be much easier to reciprocate that. It's just not happening, and it's just very it wasn't to the degree where I was like throw the whole book away, but I was just kind of like, yeah, whenever black people came up, I was kind of like, where, what is this about to give? Because like I feel like we're trying to make a point, but we're not quite there. There's like just not that awareness there.
And so I was gonna say, it makes me think there's a weird parallel here with Americana when she was talking about being in an academia and the progressiveness there. And I think to me it speaks to this point that a lot of American progressiveness, which they don't talk about, has roots in black liberation theory and black liberation philosophy. But similarly to pop culture, that part is cut out, and so people are using words and phrases. And there, you know, so he goes to college, and I think he's becoming, and I think at the beginning of the book, he is a Vietnamese American. When by the end of the book, he understands his identity as political, as a person of color, and he's in these progressive spaces that have, that put academic language to it. But the thing that all these academic spaces fail to do is understand that they're really taking from a philosophical tradition, and they're kind of just taking bits of pieces of it and not really understanding the whole part of it, and also dismissing the people who it comes from and why in particular they were speaking of it. So for him to go in and do like a moderate deep dive on oxycodone, which that's good, that was impressive and wonderful to listen to, but then not to do a deep dive into say like 50 Cent or even where the phrase "you're good" comes from, or even like the breakdown of Hartford and why it looks the way it does. It's just interesting when he takes the time to focus on and give a history to, and what he doesn't. And I think it's very indicative of, like we said last episode, like the American miasma, the soup of what we think. Anyway,
I just think it feels very surface level also to talk about like drugs in America without talking about Black communities, and like war on drugs without talking about Black communities, and like especially these types of targeted drug campaigns by pharmaceutical companies without talking about Black communities in America, because they were kind of orchestrated as like a means to completely denigrate and wipe out and have like reasons to go after certain communities. So I don't know. I definitely felt that was also kind of lacking in his analysis of examining some of the poverty through these like drug problems that he was coming to face with.
It's we mentioned that in our summary, Nino, which, you know, maybe Nino just like she's got the sight, like she just knew that we're talking, or she also right, we also could just be very well versed in history. I think your point, that's exactly, it's on the point. Like if we talk about the current opioid epidemic but not to talk about the U.S. government's like literal targeting and destruction of Black communities with the use of drugs in starting from the 70s, and penalization and criminalization for something that now has a completely different level of empathy, quote unquote. Again, I still will say empathy, quote unquote, but no resources. It's an oversight. So I agree with you.
And just to kind of add one or two more things. First of all, this is so interesting, just the time difference between when this book was published and now, because he uses the term Latinx in the book, which I also thought was very curious. It really goes back, Alka, to what you were talking about, the kind of like metamorphosis of Little Dog and the author from a kind of like Vietnamese American to like an academic American, almost as like its own type of like extension of like a white, upper class whiteness, that like that term appeared in the book, even though I think that like most people from that background do not agree with that term and don't like it being used. They like feel as though it's being used against them. Like, I don't want to go so far as to say like as an act of colonization, but it's like taking a person's language and like using it in a way that you want to impart like whiteness to it. I don't know. I just thought that was odd that was there. To talk a little bit about the "you're good" discourse that he has, I thought that it was very like striking, and I was trying to piece it together, and just like hearing you guys talk about it really helped, that he says like we in Hartford use that term, and like the "we" is doing a lot of work there, mostly because it seems as though he's implying that the "we" is like him and his mostly white friends. Like there is a kind
that's the way I got to.
Is this weird like elision of the history of the term. So and I really do think that this book would have benefited, because it is in a way, I don't want to say a love letter, but it's also like a letter to Hartford who can't read it. And like what seems to be a lack of interest in the demographic breakdown of Hartford, like where he lives versus where other people live, is talked about, but it's not like Blackness is kind of left out of that.
By the way, there's like a pretty decent Black community in Hartford.
Oh yeah.
But because I think he is in a more whiter, lower socioeconomic community in what he's writing about. But and I say that because I feel like there could be an erasure of that. But anyway, continue.
Well, no, I just think that to be interested in like a modern American community and not be interested in the ways in which it was created, which is like any really any large like American place is locally and globally created with blackness in mind. Like the kind of disinterest, maybe not disinterest, but like the lack of words about that in this novel is so odd to me, because he is really interested in how things come to be put together, but he doesn't seem to, he just doesn't seem to take into account blackness in the way that I thought that he might. And I kept on waiting for that to come up, because you're right, he mentions 50 Cent, he mentions Ray Allen, these kind of large black figures, but there isn't really much discourse on like the blackness that they came from. So
So at the beginning of the book, we said this in part one too, his lens is very much based in like being a Vietnamese immigrant and his mother's lens and his grandmother's lens. Then with Trevor, it becomes a very white American lens. I don't think at any point that lens shifts. And I wonder if he had a different experience younger, that lens would have happened. And so I think he sees America through that lens, and it causes him to miss out on some things. So at the same point, the book can be very poignant and at other times feel lacking.
And I don't know if I'm really allowed to speak to this, but I felt that also when he was working on the tobacco farm, for example, like he mentioned he had a lot of brown coworker, like, sorry, not coworkers, but people who like worked with him on the farm, where he like learned Spanish from, but that was like the extent to which they were mentioned. Like after that, the narrator completely lost interest. They were just gone, and the only person you really see from that time of his life is Trevor, who is white. There's no real mention of the work being done, of the workers there, of of any relationship with the workers there. And so I don't know, that's something I was interested in, and that also never kind of came up again either.
And even the fact that Trevor's like, isn't he like the grandchild or like the grandson of Buford, that guy who like owns his whole tobacco farm anyway? I mean, even from Trevor's end, there was no examination of like, what does that mean for me to like be kind of situated in this space? So just basically, I'm just agreeing with you, Nina.
You know what I was thinking about? He is very blunt and honest in this book, but I think he still, what's the word, obfuscates? He's still, God, who?
I know.
To be next to an F. Like, anyway, he's still, I think the thing, and I don't know, Ocean, maybe one day we'll talk about it. The thing he's trying not to say is that he'd had whiteness on a pedestal.
Yeah, I agree.
And that part with sex with Trevor, where there's this whole dynamic about being clean and good enough and not having shame again. And it's like this needing this validation through whiteness. I think he juxtaposes that.
I want to talk about that.
But when you juxtapose that to how Trevor's life goes in the end, he realizes that this whiteness thing, this empire, I mean, the empire came in and like literally caused his whole country of origin so much harm. Like this thing is actually a very fragile, broken thing. It's like an Ouroboros that's eating itself. And I think he sees that, and then he realizes that that's been an illusion, and how that illusion is not only hurting people abroad, but hurting people in the country. So I think his focus is on whiteness. I think at the very end he starts to see that and thinks about changing. maybe he'll have more to say in another book, but he doesn't in this book. Anyway, so
that's really interesting, because I couldn't quite place the relationship with whiteness. Like,
really?
I just was like, oh, like, I'm sure this is like, you know, this is like a, like when he would talk about like Trevor's like white masculinity and things like that. Like, I'm just like, how exactly are we talking about this? Like, because the way I would talk about this is sort of like from a place of critique and let's examine this and like, you know, dismantle this. But like, it felt like just observation to me. I was having a hard time placing like what exactly, where are we at right now? Like, what exactly is the lens here? So yeah, I would like to think that it was like a to your point that there was like a realization of like just like the fragility behind it all, but I'm not sure if
he even gets
where
there.
That happened, right?
First of all, in the context of like whiteness as it relates to the Vietnam War, I also thought that those sections of the book were very interesting. Again, this is like something that Nino and I text back and forth about because I think we were both having challenges about it. It feels not wishy-washy is the right word, but it feels very ambivalent toward the war. It seems to place the war as something that happens from which we can like draw other people's lives, basically a kind of manifest of not just whiteness, but like capitalist whiteness, patriarchal whiteness, like inflicted upon another culture that, again, was not at war at all with America. It seems as though there's a lack of acknowledgement of like the power imbalance that was going on in that war. And like a kind of ambivalence of the events that were happening, like helicopters, which he mentions a few times, and bombs that are dropped aren't peopled. They're just objects that happen to be in Vietnam. Like there aren't people behind them. I thought that was very odd. There's a lot of interviews about him talking about how war is wrong in general, but like that makes me feel uncomfortable as a more left-leaning person because I feel as though there's deeper like analysis that has to go into that, that he just seems very opposed to this kind of patriarchal form of like violence, which I think is very fair. But I think that like decolonization is a process by which like violence has to occur. And there isn't an acknowledgement of the differences between like modern white American violence versus like other types of violence. I don't know. And I'd love to just plow ahead if I can, unless anyone wants to say anything back to that. I'd love to talk about the scene where Trevor and Little Dog have sex for the first time. If that's okay. Unless anyone wants to say something.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So this
also was very challenging for me in a lot of different ways. First of all, yes, the kind of traditional roles that these characters are taking within a queer community is very strange. That like Little Dog as this younger, literally little dog, this almost dehumanized object, is Asian and is seen as being femme for being Asian, but also lives up to the role of being femme, is then like enjoys kind of being ruined by this boy who is very caught up in his own white masculinity. He like eats a lot of beef, does a lot of drugs, things like that. And like, and then he feels so invalidated by not being clean, and then is cleaned by that same like white mouth, and first thinks that he mishears Trevor telling him to like lick it up, and then feels so validated when Trevor is the one to lick it up. All felt very odd. And I also just wanted to like bring mention to a line that, which is very complicated to me, when he says getting fucked in the ass felt good. I learned when you outlast your own hurt. Maybe I'm just like a good bottom, but like I don't, there's this trend in literature and in like media as a whole to depict like anal intercourse as something that is inherently painful, and once you outlast the pain, it turns into something good. It's like an act of violence in and of itself, as opposed to, I would say, like more non-queer forms of intercourse that I understand has some basis in reality, but like not always. And
not required.
It's not a requisite. And even then, I don't think that that always happens. I think that like, you know, that like there's
we talked about using lube.
Or just like even that, there's like the interactions between the partners that can make it easier. There's like a lot of things in which anal is not inherently this act of hurt that is inflicted from the top upon the bottom. It places this very like heteronormative and also patriarchal view on how queer sex takes place. It almost makes it more heteronormative than like actual heterosex, in which like I feel like depictions of that are oftentimes, there might be like a difference of interest, but there is oftentimes not a difference of pain. I just feel as though oftentimes when like explicit anal sex is talked about in media, it's a depiction of pain. I just really implore authors to shy away from that. I feel as though we've like heard enough of pain. There's something, there can be something very like validating about it. And like from the beginning, there doesn't have to be this inherent wrongness that like pain is being inflicted upon a person so that they can achieve like a kind of numb pleasure, which is what he talks about. I just, I know that it's somewhat accurate. I just want us to move like away from that. So like just using that all the time to talk about deeper things. Anal is good. It's my main point here.
You know, I'm so happy you said that, because honestly, I mean, even just like on a logistical tip, they went from 0 to 100. Yeah. Like there was no, talk of like foreplay, kind of just get it. You know, it just seemed very abrupt. It was just like, there's this no lube. I got like some spit and I'm just going to like put my dick in you and just hope that this, you know, like, and I'm just like, this is, we were not really setting ourselves up for success here. Like, it's just like, and to your point, it's like, I think that it's just like, I'm really glad you mentioned the piece around sort of it being an act of violence, like sort of like pain being inflicted upon somebody. And like, I think queer sex is already so pathologized that it's like, do we really need to like make the cultural understanding of it like inherently violent and painful by nature? Like that doesn't really help anyone. And it's interesting because like the racial implications of that whole scene were not lost on me, especially when I think we look at mainstream sort of queer spaces, sort of the feminization of Asian men, sort of the assumption that like, you know, this, oh, this person's gonna bottom, like whatever, and like kind of, you know, bottom shaming, femphobia, all that shit. Like for me, little dog liking bottoming and things like that, that whatever, that's fine. But it's just kind of like, I feel like with Trevor though, I'm like, Trevor is not capturing the nuance of how you're approaching this. And I think that's the part that really is frustrating to me, because it's,
and
like,
he doesn't have to because he's white.
Right. And it's just like, he's like, oh, like I don't want to be, you know, like gay. Like he didn't say the word gay, he said a slur, but like, you know, like, he's just like, is very much caught up in his own shit that I'm like, he's, this does feel very extractive in a way that I just don't like. And it's like, I'm all for like deconstructing what like our mainstream norms around what power is and where power lies in sex and all of that. But like, I just, I don't know, with Trevor? No, nah. it's a no for me. But yeah, just really glad you said that.
Well, and there's also just something really curious again about the politics of like Trevor as this, I don't want to say self-hating or even self-denying, because we don't know exactly. I don't think he knows who he is in this way, but Trevor as this kind of traditional white, quasi-closeted, top-only kind of bro, like being able to validate little dog by like, I mean, basically like rimming him after the event. There is something very tender and very beautiful and very intimate about that. And I really applaud like Ocean for writing that. I think that it is very like wonderful. But again, like the racial and just kind of queer aspects of that interaction are then not expanded upon. Like this idea of this white top having the decency to show kindness, and that should be like validated, and through it is able to like bless little dog with his tongue. It almost feels like a kind of baptism that this white top is able to like baptize the like dirty water of this femme Asian bottom, and then it's not explored in greater detail. It felt, I don't know, it just, again, it just made me uncomfortable. And it's a good thing that art is able to do that to me. I just feel as though it deserves, like, a mention in that way.
Yeah. You know what I kind of want to, I think you guys are hitting on some really valid points. I think, thinking about this in 2000, in, what was it, 4 or 3 or 5? Yeah. I think for Little Dog to grow up in America during that time, and in the community he did, this is what I mean, where I think the lens of his focus is on whiteness, because I think in the time that he lived in America as a teenager, I think whiteness was overpowering. Mm-hmm. Like, who's George Bush is the president? Like, whiteness. like we've never had a black president in 2004. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think we underestimate just how permeating mm-hmm. whiteness as the valid standard has been and mm-hmm. how recently, if not currently, it is. And so I agree with you. I wish he had deconstructed that more, but I still think he's explaining the landscape yeah. and the way he saw it at the time, which mm-hmm. I think that's the tragedy of it.
Yeah.
But I would posit to say that he's not alone as someone who had that feeling
yeah.
and maybe he's overcome it now. And that's why I think the second part where he talks about how the opioid crisis is sort of effects on Trevor, where he like sort of starts to see that like this person, this whiteness that you would use to venerate you, which I think is the word you might have been looking for. Maybe not.
Yes. But, there we go. That's good.
is actually an illusion. And it's mm-hmm. always been an illusion. Yeah. Even when he didn't think it was an illusion, even mm-hmm. when it was like giving him something of quote unquote value, it's always been an illusion. Mm-hmm. And it's the biggest illusion America's ever pulled. Yeah. I mean, Jesus, yeah. you could pull a bunny out of a hat. Like, it's that good of a trick.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, yeah, anyway, I just thought I would add that piece. I think your analysis is accurate,
yeah.
though.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. There are some quotes around being subversive that initially reading made me kind of uncomfortable, but I think after hearing you talk, Akko, it's helping me reconceptualize it, because there are some lines where the narrator is like, sometimes you have to be a door and let Trevor like walk in and out, and you're just kind of a mat on the floor that you let Trevor like walk in and out of, or you kind of get rid of your own ego, I guess, to allow mm-hmm. this other person to be elevated. And this type of like subversiveness is being described in kind of beautiful language almost, and in a way where like it feels like the narrator sometimes feels empowered through it. And when I first mm-hmm. read it, I couldn't tell if it was actually like the narrator finding power and strength and like it actually being like a good thing that he saw it that way, or if it was kind of like a self-deluding type of thing that needed further mm-hmm. analysis. But maybe after hearing Akko talk, maybe it was more the former. But yeah, I wasn't sure. Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe Nino, but
maybe,
maybe
not.
not.
Yeah.
Back to our case yeah. with the love potion. Maybe none of us know that.
Maybe just not.
But I do want to yeah. say that here's a question or a thought:
mm.
the destruction of your own ego in conversation or in elevation, reverence of someone else. Maybe that's not the weak part. So he's saying that's what I was able to do, Trevor. Was never able to do that. Trevor needs his ego. He needs the whiteness. Mm. He needs the masculinity, mm. just like his father needs his. And maybe that's what he's pointing to as the weakness. He's like, for instance, Marcy and I think we have a very good relationship. Maybe not. Marcy would disagree.
No.
but I think a lot of the reasons it's good is because at any given point, if I'm thinking about Marcy, I'm thinking less about myself and more mm. about Marcy. Mm. And I would posit a belief that that's what Marcy is doing too. Could be wrong, but I think so. And I don't even just posit. I trust in that they are. Yeah. And I think mm-hmm. that's what makes the relationship work. But I can't make Marcy do that. Just like they right. can't make me do that. Yeah. And I think maybe what Little Dog is saying, and this is like I'm anxious saying it because it's so un-American. Like, if I do it, that's all I can do. All I can yeah. do is be strong enough to hold space for you. If you ever get to the point, it's like the key in the mouth given from the wife to Houdini.
Yeah.
If you can use this to unclasp yourself, then we both exist in this free love together. Not to point out Giovanni's room again, but Giovanni's room.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he felt like Trevor never could take the key and unlock himself, and that's why he unfortunately passed. And maybe he's hoping with this book it unlocks it for other people. But I, so anyway, that's my thinking. I don't It might be a delusion, like you said, Nino, and it might just be unexamined. That's also possible.
Yeah, yeah, I just, that's fair. To like continue on what you were talking about, Akko, I agree with all of that. I'm just very interested. And again, it's hard to tell exactly, again, where fiction ends and his own life begins. I'm interested in the traditionalist casting of the top as the person who is like not in touch with their own self.
Yeah.
And then the bottom is this person who, through the like infliction of pain at the beginning, is able to give themselves up and like help the top achieve this kind of like, or attempt to help this top achieve something. I don't know. I just,
yeah,
there's,
yeah, it's a good,
there's
point.
Like something so insidious about the ways that like we view bottoming, I think, as an extension of the kind of like ways that we view women, that like,
yeah, I agree with
you
that.
Give up this thing that hurts at first, but then eventually you're kind of driven into like pleasure, and through it you can achieve this like connection to this other person. I don't know. I just like, I
yeah,
think that
I agree with you. I don't think that's necessary.
I think that those are valid feelings, and I think that if I only saw it in this book, I would feel like cool about it. But I just think that there is a tendency in queer literature to use those castings, and whether or not that's like valid to the real world, which I think it is less common than people would like to say. I think that it's like heterosexualizing like in inherent queerness, and then yeah, obviously mix in with like their races and what those mean within the queer community. I don't know, there's just like a lot to unpack there in that way.
Yeah. Well, your point is well, like, so in the part when we talked about power is a dynamic that flows back and forth, but a power that is a dynamic doesn't have to look any type of shape or way, yeah. Right? And it's like, to your point, Ethan, like, this is the shape that, I don't know, America, modernity, oppressors, I don't know, whatever, choose whatever, has decided that's where it's going to land. But you're like, but we could even be more creative than that. Like,
right.
And in fact, that's just like, that's not the beginning of how these like exchanges of energy have been. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to continue that way either, which is exactly to your point. And it might be the way it's enacted when people think in those terms, like you're saying, like in a heterosexual, patriarchal lens. Yeah. But what if we became imaginative with everything, yeah, like we have been in the past, like not like we became like a progressive narrative, but like a destruction of the idea that's always been the dynamic, like you're saying, there has to be a femme bottom and a masculine top, and the masculine top doesn't need to understand like what it means to be a human who like cares about the person they're top. Like none of these things have to be true, and nor are they true currently. Yeah. But I really think Trevor and Little Dog too, not having role models in the early 2000s and stuck in this mindset, don't know how to have these conversations outside of that. And I think there's a lot of shame. Like the part I think they're not talking about is how much they feel like they need to do this secretly, which I think is why they didn't buy any lube. I personally think,
no, I agree.
It has to do with it.
Makes it premeditated.
interesting.
Wow. This can we just stay on for like four more? Like we're just like gonna have a 6-hour episode of the Color Pages book club. But I mean, not that this is the end of the conversation, but yeah, like, would love to just kind of wrap up here, if that's okay with folks. Yeah. Like, before we do, though, I'm just curious, are there any other, like, resonant thoughts, any other impressions, any other things that folks wanted to kind of, like, bring into the space?
Yeah, just really quickly, after reading this book, I listened to some interviews with Ocean Vuong, and he's mentioned that he is pretty devoutly Buddhist, and sees himself giving up writing to become more of like a Buddhist monk. Yeah. So, and after learning that, I don't know, I think some of the more spiritual elements in the book and some of the ways in which he like mentions animals, for example, were kind of recast slightly in my mind. Just wanted to throw that out there. Yeah.
That's dope.
Yeah. It's kind of cool that he's like, well, that was fun.
Yeah.
I'm
going to
be a beast monkey.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, cute for a little bit, but we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my like last thought's kind of meta. I don't know. I wonder, I don't know if you guys like in any way, because he's a big name, like reach out to him with the publication of your first episode. I feel like, do you think you'd be interested in listening to this? You should be like, hey, Ocean.
Because I mean, he
is one of those authors where I would love for him to like respond to the things that we're talking about here, because I think that without knowing the exact author's intentionality, it is somewhat difficult. And yeah, I feel like we've kind of raised some difficult things here that I would love to like hear him answer in some capacity. So I don't know. I just,
So. I mean, Ocean, if you're listening,
yeah, please.
Our email is open. Yeah. Like
if we at him on Twitter, you think
that actually is not a bad idea.
I'll give a shot. Just,
I mean, it hasn't been the only. I mean, authors have responded.
Yeah,
before, yeah,
so, yeah. That's true. Yeah.
So, yeah. What about you, Akko?
My last thought is a quote. This line he says, and I think this is part of him expanding or defining himself in a way that. And overcoming. He says, all this time I told myself we were born from war. But I was wrong, Ma. We were born from beauty. Let no one mistake us for the fruit of violence, that the violence, having passed through the fruit, failed to spoil it. Mm-hmm. I really liked that. I really dug it. I think it's the point of the whole book. Yeah. And so that's all.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. And yeah, honestly, it's hard to summarize my thoughts on this book. After this conversation, I'll be honest, I was very much like, this book, sickening, perfect. And now I'm like, you know, maybe we can go back and kind of analyze some of it a bit more. Because yeah, I think I really want to kind of sit with a lot of this conversation, because not to say that this book needs to be like, you know, dropped down as far as like how I see it, but yeah, just kind of introducing
I think the best books lend themselves to these kind of really difficult, complicated questions that like authors the best authors are the people, and this is like a very difficult thing to do, is to make shape of the things that you don't know and to place them in your book in a way that you are asking your readers to like look in themselves and maybe help you, or just to help the world kind of come to answers to these things that you don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think that there's a lot, like there's a lot of that. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of like not knowing in this book, and I don't know. I think that's really like, that's a good thing. Yeah. It's very beautiful.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Perhaps even gorgeous.
I love it.
Anyway, so, as we wrap up, Nino, Ethan, thank you both so much again for joining us. This conversation was like
phenomenal,
truly on some other shit in like the best way. I feel like my brain stretched like for 2 hours. Like I feel like I did a gymnastics routine. Like I'm just like, oh my god, there's so much to think about. But
thank you for going there with us. You know, you don't, it's an act of vulnerability to like go to the depths of like the middle of a poetry book stream of consciousness. And you guys, we really appreciate you. So,
yeah. And where can folks follow up with you?
Anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can find us just by searching Left Shelf. We're also on Instagram at left.shelf. Twitter at Left Shelf Podcast, and then email leftshelfpodcast@gmail.com. So yeah, check us out if you're in the mood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would just love to kind of toss it back. I'm really grateful that we've gotten to meet you guys and like talk with you. Yeah. I don't know. I just think that you're like thinkers, you're curious. It's just really wonderful to talk to people who read like literature in the same way that I do, but come from different backgrounds and are able to offer things that I would never be able to even like think of. So I don't know. I just like really thank you for having us on and for putting us on for what turned out to be like a very, very, very good book. So thank you.
Yeah.
Of course. Oh my God.
Thanks,
yes,
y'all.
Yes, of course. Anytime.
That's true. So if you all want to follow us, unfortunately, we don't have a consistency in tags like Left Shelf Book Responsible. So first off, the top is Twitter, at the Color Pages. You weren't going to add us there anyway, but on Instagram, it's at thesecolorpages. That's what's up. Our email is thesecolorpages@gmail.com. And we have a website, thesecolorpages.com.
Yes, of course, of course. And, you know, if this show brought you any love, light, delight, yes, because we're talking about what? Poetry, yes. Please leave us some love wherever you're listening to this podcast. Mm. Could be Apple Podcasts or not. While you're there, also leave some love for Left Shelf Podcast because they are out here doing the damn thing. With this episode specifically, if you really liked it and you know, there's just someone in your life that's like, you know what, this person needs just sort of like these lyrical stream of consciousness, like comment, like whatever this episode gave you, just send them the link, no context, just send them the link and then just like throw your phone into a river and just completely forget about it because actions like that, both chaotic and helpful in augmenting our community. So thank you all so much. Next time, we are going to be getting into one of my picks, which is actually called A Time to Dance by Padma Venkatraman. And yes, between now and then, Akko, are there any other things we should leave our listeners with before we head out?
No, just until we see you next time, just remember to
stay colorful.
Yay!
Oh my God. So I'm going to stop this recording.
Okay.
Which is, oh my God.
Too.